At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
This is livemint.com, and you're listening to Mint Editors Podcast with me, Ajay Vaishnav, and Mint's consulting editor, Sandeep Khanna. Finance Minister Mr. Arun Jaitley saying that the government is working on a stimulus package to revive the economy. And we have also done stories that the economy is in a tailspin. So what is your expectation? How the government should go about it? We anyways know that in last few years, we have witnessed a jobless growth and then demonetization has also sort of decelerated the economy.
I think it's ironical that, you know, we are talking about a stimulus in India on a day when the Fed is just about brought to a close its historic quantitative easing of 2009. And, you know, the fact that India is in need of a stimulus, I think, is now almost a foregone conclusion. To my mind, the first important thing about what Mr. Jaitley has been talking about is the fact that there is a tacit acknowledgement that we have a problem. We have an investment problem. And the economists now tell us and the markets now tell us that we also have a consumption problem. There is just no demand at both ends. So it's this double whammy that we've been seeing for quite some time. I mean, it does in a sense predate the NDA regime, but I think the expectation was that in 2014, when there was a change in the government, the expectation was that the new government would be in some senses be able to stoke demand. That hasn't happened quite clearly. So Mr. Jaitley very pragmatically has kind of decided to bite the bullet. Now, we don't really know what the contours of this stimulus are actually going to be like. Yeah. It's fairly early days and, you know, typically a stimulus can take many forms. The idea of a stimulus obviously is to stimulate demand in the economy, and you can do that by pumping in money into the economy, or the government can go on some kind of a spending spree. You can also cut taxes, and I mean that's an option that's available to Mr. Jaitley with the budget coming up in 3 to 4 months. The chances of that happening are a little remote because we saw in the last budget there was a cut in the corporate tax rates for SMEs. It didn't really lead to too much of a demand. In fact, the big problem in India is that the SME sector's growth has been really, really poor, and that's been the sad part of it. Now, how much demonetization is responsible for it, how much the whole adjustment to the new GST regime is responsible for it, we don't really know. I mean, to come back to your question, I mean, what can we expect from the finance minister? I think the most obvious solution at this point is to see if the government can stimulate demand by spending on infrastructure sectors, spending on things like rural housing, rural roads. And Dr. Pranab Sen in a piece in Mint has talked about doing small things rather than the big things. I mean, things like, you know, high-speed train, a bullet train, those are the big things, and those are large investments requiring large capital investment, but those are very long-term. You know, the impact of that would probably not be felt for about 5 years. What we need is something which will have an immediate impact on the economy, and government spending in infrastructure sectors, on roads, on highways, and a bit of that, we are seeing that happen. You know, we've seen railways going on some kind of spending thing. We've seen the government trying to stoke demand in the rural markets. But maybe what we need is a clear plan now, saying this is how much the government is going to spend, this is how much the government is going to pump into the economy. And, you know, the good thing about that would be that it would in turn stimulate demand from other sectors like cement and steel and aluminium. And in a sense, it would also give the SME sector some kind of relief by, you know, creating demand for their products and services. So yeah, I think the thing that we can look forward to and we can hope for is that the government decides to spend big. It's also politically expedient because, you know, we're just a couple of years from an election coming up. So when the government spends, it's obviously it's going to reflect on the government, and you know, the political dividend for that will be high.
And in hindsight, it seems that former PM Manmohan Singh was probably right when he called demonetization as a monumental mismanagement. And I have a question. PM has been saying that he wants to double farm income. How much it will help in putting the Indian economy back on track?
It certainly would. I mean, one of the reasons for, you know, the slowdown in growth, I mean, the fact that we're at 5.7%, probably the lowest in the last 3 years, is also the fact that there just has been no rural demand.
Yeah.
And that's because our agricultural sector hasn't been growing. So PM's vision there is absolutely spot on. We need to kickstart the agriculture sector. We need to kickstart growth in that sector, because that will translate into, you know, at least in segment sectors like FMCG, in sectors like lots of these sectors, we will see demand if rural incomes start going up. In areas like consumer durables, for instance, where we've seen some pickup in demand, it has come from the rural sector.
Although the vision is good, but the initial trends suggest that rainfall may be deficient, especially in central and southeastern regions. So I'm not sure how fast we can double that income.
You probably can't double it, in any case. It will take a long time to bring some kind of stability to demand in the rural sector. But I think that, the fact that the monsoon hasn't quite met expectations, at least at this point of time, might be at the back of the FM's mind, when he's talking about a stimulus. It is, good governments always do that. They anticipate what's going to happen in the economy over the next 6 months to 1 year. And maybe he's got that at the back of his mind when he's talking about a stimulus.
Moving on to the next story, the next big development comes from the telecom sector. TRAI has reduced interconnection usage charges. Well, it was anticipated, but what TRAI has done, it has reduced it by as much as 57%. Already Vodafone and Airtel, they are not happy. They've even said that this one will help Reliance Jio than any other player.
Yeah, the war in the telecom space in India, it's been going on for a while. And, the reduction in the interconnection charges, it was anticipated, like you said. In the last 15 years or so, the rates have come down from 30 paise to 14 paise per minute. And there was expectation that they would be cut further. And to be fair, given the technologies that are available today to all these telecom providers, especially those who are using 4G technologies, it's only fair that, in a user pays regime, the termination with the operator with whom the call is terminating, eventually, there is a cut in those rates. Whether it should have been to the quantum that we are seeing, 57%, or it should have been 20%, I think that's the moot point. That's something that, they can argue. The fact is, Airtel and Vodafone are going to suffer the most. I'd like to take a slightly variant point on that, which is that, given that they are the two largest players in the market, any time when you cut interconnection charges, they would be the ones who would feel the pain the most. And you'd expect that, by now they would have kind of adjusted, one, their balance sheets, and two, their technologies. One of the reasons why they're complaining is also because Reliance is the Jio is the only one which has a complete 4G network. Mm-hmm. And most of them are using legacy technologies, 2G technologies even now for voice calls. So which is why the impact is going to be felt. And we know that the impact is going to be substantial. From whatever figures I have seen, almost about 14% of their profits come from these charges. And if those are going to be impacted, their balance sheets are already under some strain, and this will put, even more strain on that. And I think the bigger worry for them is the fact that, the savings that will accrue to Jio, they can be utilized then by Jio for even more, let's say predatory pricing, if I could use that word. And that's going to be a worry for these. But I don't know what readers or what users have to say about it. But the fact of the matter is that as a telecom user, if you're going to be paying lower tariffs, I don't think you're going to be complaining.
Yeah.
And, so here, in a sense, the incumbents are a bit on the lonely side. And they'll have to figure out how best, they can adjust to it.
Another development which cannot be ignored in the corporate sector is shareholders of Tata Sons have voted to make the company a private holding company. Where it is going?
It's a culmination of what started in September, October last year, mm-hmm. when Cyrus Mistry was axed from the board as chairman of Tata Sons. And I suppose at that point of time, the Tata Group, the primary holders, they figured that, they needed to bulletproof the holding company, Tata Sons, which is because, at the end of the day, the Cyrus Mistry family has a substantial stake in Tata Sons. So this was one move that, in a sense, renders the ability of the Mistry family to be able to sell their holding to a competitor, which mm-hmm. is what we understand. If they were to, for instance, sell their entire holding, that would make the Tata Group, the Tata family and the existing shareholders of Tata Sons a little more vulnerable. So it was, in a sense, probably the the thing that they were doing. Whether there is any legal issue involved in this is something that now the NCLT will take up eventually. There is a 3-month breathing period in which they can then go to NCLT and seek their permission for this. Cyrus Mistry obviously has objected, and his point is quite clear that, you know, the it's not just his family's holding, but also the fact that companies like individual companies like Tata Steel and Tata Power and Tata Motors, they all have small but significant shareholding in Tata Sons, and now that in a sense is rendered not fungible. They can't sell it, you know, without permission. But, you know, what we are told is that the Articles of Association of Tata Sons in any case didn't allow them to sell their stakes without permission of the existing shareholder. So I think the affected party is obviously the Mistry family, and they will probably take this battle forward. So I think the messiness that has been there for the last, you know, 1 year or so, it's going to be extended even more. And it's a bit of a pity, but I mean, in a sense, it's because, you know, nobody thought through the structure of the group and the holding company when it was being conceptualized in all of these years, and it's come to a head now.
Google HTC deal. Google, again, it has agreed to buy a stake in HTC's research and design department. They have done it in the past also. They bought Motorola, and of course the aim at that time was to buy its patents and secure them.
Sure.
What is the reason for HTC deal, and how it will help them to compete against Apple?
So, I mean, you've given the answer yourself. The reason is simple. It's a Google versus Apple battle. Mm-hmm. And on the hardware platform, Google hasn't been able to make any inroads. And you said that, you know, they bought the Motorola business for the patents. Well, they bought it obviously for the hardware and the patents, but eventually they couldn't do much with Motorola's thing, which is why they sold off that business. They retained the patent. So in a sense, it's Google's second attempt at getting into the hardware business. And, you know, from Google's perspective, the amount of money that they've paid, it's a fairly small amount to actually see if they can. I think what they're buying into is HTC's R&D. HTC was already making the Pixel phones that the Android phones for Google. So in a sense, it's basically buying your own supplier.
Yeah.
And but I think what they're looking at actually is the platform that is going to be available to them. HTC has been making smartphones for a long time. And, you know, what they realized was with Apple, and especially the latest Apple launches, that Apple's built this huge ecosystem these years, and that allows them to actually, you know, they can use pricing, they can use product features, all of that, to impact the market in very substantial ways. And if you look at the margins that Apple has from that business, none of the hardware manufacturers in the Android platform has been able to achieve anything near that. You know, so I think that is what Google sees, and we're probably going to see a few more acquisitions in that space. Also, I mean, a lot of these Chinese manufacturers, you know, they seem to have hit the plateaued out in a sense. There's been way too much of competition. We've seen a couple of them actually, go into bankruptcy. And for them also, it seemed like a fairly smart deal, although there have been some questions on whether HTC has got the best out of this deal or not. But certainly from Google's point of view, it's still just a little toehold that they put into the business of hardware. It's going to be a long time before they can be, you know, if they can compete directly with Apple for the high margin phones. But I think they're looking to get into it, to be able to use their other advantages which they have at this point of time.
In fact, one analyst from Counterpoint, he said that it's as much as an emotional decision also. You are actually bailing out that particular department.
I don't know about that. I mean, the hardcore world of corporate finance, I don't know if emotions play a role. But I mean, you know, you obviously, you've been dealing with a company for a long time, you have an existing relationship with them, and then you feel the need and you look at various players in the market and you say, look, I'm comfortable with these guys, I've been doing business with them. That is a matter of trust. I think, you know, it's
maybe
a fairly obvious choice.
The last issue is Mahindra is betting big on electric vehicles, and they have also agreed to cooperate with Ford Motor and driverless segment also. So how big this segment will be and how long it will take before we actually reach that point where electric vehicle can compete as much as petrol and diesel cars, and how much government can do, because we know it's a clean technology,
right?
But we don't have the infrastructure also.
I think it's fairly early days. Anand Mahindra in Bloomberg conference in New York, he did mention that we seem to be reaching the point where we can start becoming a viable business. But there is a difference between it becoming a viable business for an individual company or a set of companies And, you know, for it to be actually substituting existing, you know, fuel-based vehicles. I think that's a long time off. Best case scenario, analysts say that it will take at least about 7 to 8 years for electric vehicles to be a third of the overall vehicle market. And how much of that would be available in India, whether the Indian consumer has the appetite at this point of time to pay the extra price that you would need to for hybrid or for electric vehicles, it remains to be seen. Mahindra, they have been in this business for a long time. I mean, they've been trying to make inroads into the electric vehicle space, also because they haven't really made it in the passenger car market with existing technologies. So it's a nice way of flanking, you know, existing technologies. You come in with green vehicles and you're seen as, you know, the company with the green vehicle, with the only green vehicles in the business. There is a payoff for it. But I think there is a lot of regulatory and legislative changes that will be needed in India before we can convert to a, you know, a green vehicle economy in that sense.
So those were Sandeep Khanna's top stories this week. Do let us know what you think. You can email us at feedback@livemint.com or follow us at Livemint on Twitter and Mint on Facebook. The Editor's Podcast is also available on iTunes and audioboom.com. Please click on subscribe button on iTunes to get weekly updates of latest episodes. Thank you for listening and see you next Friday.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.